Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners, all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest for today's seminar is the architect Michael Diamant. Michael is the founder of the social media network, New Traditional Architecture, that has helped to popularize the classical architecture tradition. Michael studied society planning at Stockholm University, majoring in urban sociology. He felt a need for a channel to spread awareness that there is an option to the dominant modernist thinking in architecture and city planning. New Traditional Architecture was founded in 2013 and has since its inception spawned local groups that have successfully changed the public discussion about architecture in Scandinavia and beyond. A lot of attention is also given to networking and helping people discover like-minded people both locally and internationally. Today, content from Michael's social media pages can be found all over the internet, increasing interest for New Traditional Architecture and inspiring more to aspire to become classical architects. While much of his focus has been on content creation, Michael has increasingly been interviewed in media, podcasts, and film interviews about his views on architecture and urban planning. I found Michael's views on architecture very interesting and very relevant to the audience of this podcast. If you've read my book, The Bitcoin Standard or the Fiat Standard, you see the discussion of time preference, and I make the argument that things changed when it comes to time preference after the move from gold as money to fiat as money, and I argue that that has been reflected in architecture. I'm not an architect, however. It's not something that I've studied very closely. It's not something that I can speak about with a lot of authority, but today we have somebody who can. So I'm very happy to be welcoming Michael here and to get his opinion on architecture, why it has changed, and how it can be fixed. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I can frustrate that I'm not, neither am I an architect, and it doesn't matter. We both have the right to have an opinion about our built environment. It's the modernists that have succeeded in telling everyone that if you're not an architect, you have no right to comment your own built environment where you live every day. But both you and I are experts because we use the built environment every day. So of course we have the right, you know, and preferences and, you know, opinions, what to think about, you know, what we see. Yeah, with that said, you know, it's a very wide topic, but it's not that complicated that modernists want to make it. Your argument is very valid. It's part, you know, it's one part of the broader culture change of society. You know, moving away from generational building, moving away from, you know, trusting the future. Everything goes faster and faster. This process, of course, began, you know, already in the 19th century. We had, you know, the first globalization. Okay, the first globalization, I would say, was in the 16th century. But then gradually, you know, it evolved more and more and more. And yeah, everything's a quick buck now. And what differs this time from previous time is that many people, both architects and developers and builders, they don't live in the place where they, you know, create their buildings or where they build. So they have no skin in the game. I think that's the term that you use in American English. So if you build an ugly building, you don't care. You don't live there. If you live in a place and, you know, you're going to meet locals every day, you're a bit, little bit more sensitive, you know, what you are doing. It doesn't matter. It's not only architecture. It's like every field. If you will close a manufacturing plant and it will affect your neighbors, if you are an owner of a big manufacturing plant and you live in the place. So this, you know, this disconnection from the local and everything is just, you know, figures on a computer screen. Yeah, that has alienated very much, you know, from our built environment. But all this is a part of the broader culture change. And within the architecture field, I would say that it's mainly the ideology of modernism that has, you know, made the whole environment change.
Okay, so I'm curious here about what is your definition of classical architecture and how is it different from modernist architecture? I'm familiar with the terms, but I'd like you to expound on more on what makes classical architecture classical and what makes modern architecture modern.
A great question. And this is very, very important to define because I never use, there's often a confusion you call classical style. You use the style argument all the time that this is some kind of style wars, but it is not. I use the term classical tradition. And when I mean that, I don't, you know, single, it's not an individual single style. It's a framework and an architecture philosophy, how you create, design a building. So within this framework, there's a limited amount of classical styles. You know, if you go back, you know, before 1945, there were endless amounts of different classical styles. So there is not one classical styles, and the majority of all classical styles have not been invented yet. So it's a framework and a tradition. And this tradition, it's important to stress that this is not only Greek or Roman tradition. You know, when we're discussing, you know, in US and Europe, of course, it will be the Greek or Roman tradition that is the foundation of our classical tradition. But there is, you know, Islamic classical architecture. You have, you know, Sinosphere, East Asian classical architecture. You have South Asian, broadly you can call it Hindu architecture. So it's many, many different traditions. And these traditions are not styles. They are a way of thinking when you design a building. And they are also the philosophy, what is important when you design a building. You know, what ratios, what should we think about? What proportions are important? What is important in our culture to stress when we build a building?
Okay.
So that's the definition of the classical architecture and the classical tradition. Not a style, not older styles, it's the framework. And we can create new styles like they did before. You know, before World War II, you had Art Deco was very popularized in the US. And you could actually, yes, you could say that it is a classical style because it has more in common with, it used new technology, but at the same time, it has more in common with the classical tradition than it has with postmodernism. You know, how you frame the facade, how you divide the facade, part symmetries, just the will to create something beautiful. And this, the view that beauty is something objective and measurable. Modernism, you know, the opposition, has relativized the new concept of beauty. It's just a matter of taste. It's just eye of the beholder. You hear all this crap. And that's not true. Before 1945, you know, we lived in much more religious societies. So the absolute truth came from God. So you didn't need to argue about, you know, beauty and ugliness because there was, you know, an absolute truth. But now, you know, with increased secularization, post-war, then we have relatives. Everything is just a matter of perception and view. And this fits. If you're a developer, you're very happy with this view. You can build any crap and just say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And that's what's happened.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is very astute. I think the focus on beauty is something that you see in many fields, is not just in architecture, but I think even in people's personal appearances. You know, we live in a world that's trying to jam down our throats the idea that basically having any kind of discernment about the way that you look or the way that others look is somehow evil, that, you know, everybody should.
Yeah, you have the fat acceptance movement. You know, every weakness of human character, instead of saying, you know, we don't hate you, but you should work, you should strive and work to improve yourself, it's acceptance. So we should accept every, you know, weakness and not only accept it, we should like almost aspire to it. And if we don't aspire to be fat and ugly or sleazy, then we are supremacists of some kind. You know, it's really bizarre.
It is absurd, and it's absolutely destructive for the people who engage in this, because, you know, it portrays to people the idea that you were born in this way, and this is just how you're going to be, and there's nothing you can do about it. And the only thing that you should do about it is just indulge yourself and embrace your ugliness, embrace the fact that you don't take care of the way you look, embrace the fact that you don't take care of your health. And instead of trying to change yourself, which, you know, let's forget about that because that's hard and we don't like to do hard things, go do the actually relatively easier thing, which is just go around and demand that other people change, which I think is a very common thing you see among authoritarians, in that I've never seen an authoritarian who you could look at and you say, this person has real control over themselves. Like, it's impossible. Like, the to be able to control yourself is so difficult. To be able to live your life according to what you want, no matter what you do with your life, you know, simply being able to control yourself, controlling your food, controlling your habits, controlling yourself in your relations with others is extremely difficult. And any person who's actually trying it realizes trying to control other people is much, 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 much difficult. And, you know, the most that you want to get away with is maybe controlling your own children, which is hell difficult. The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, it's increasingly hard. I know. I have a 15-year-old daughter, you know, and it's like, I understand why people move to the countryside. Yeah. You know, really, you know, living in the city. With them.
Yeah, but like,
but what you say is true, and it's not new, because you know, if you read, you know, old Greek texts, you know, of Stoicism, you know, fighting one's desires is also a very central part of both Christianity and Buddhism, you know, and Greek philosophy, you know, to aspire for something higher, not just being an animal, you know, fighting to self-control, self-awareness. Of course, you should enjoy life, but you should not throw yourself head on to all the to decadence, more or less, you know, to eating too much, chasing sex or women, all these kind of things that, you know, bring self-destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the only way that we can have human civilization in the most loosely defined way, you know, the only reason we can get out of being monkeys slinging our feces at each other under the trees in the forest and move away from that into building societies, building permanent structures that we can live in, having social relations with one another, having peaceful relations with one another, collaborating with each other to repel outside threats like, you know, the environment and the rain. And the only way that we can do all of that comes from essentially curbing our inner animalistic desires. Everybody has those. Everybody would like to eat everything that comes across them. Everybody would like to, you know, attack anybody that upsets them in even the slightest way. Everybody would like to indulge their sexual desires in the most direct way. And yet the only reason...
Sleep with every woman you see, basically.
Yeah, but the only reason we have a society is because we learn to control that. And I think, you know, this idea that you should just indulge yourself, you should just, everything is valid, everything is fine, it's ridiculous, because you extend this and the result is we end up being monkeys slinging our feces at each other all day. In the forest, in the jungle, really, because that's what it is to not have self-control. It's what differentiates us from animals. They just act based on their instinct, whereas we have a brain, and reason is what differentiates us. And this is something that my favorite economist, Mises, stresses a lot and discusses in depth, which is reason is what differentiates us, and it allows us to act as human beings rather and action as a form of rational thought applied to the world. We look at the world, we think, we decide, you know, this would be better. Maybe we should stop slinging feces at each other. How about we take a break from that and see if we can build a house for each other together that will help us both benefit? That's reason. And it only comes along from the curbing of our instincts. And it only comes along because we sacrifice the present, you know, the desire of the present, me needing to throw something at you to hurt you because you made me feel bad for whatever reason. I put that aside, I sacrifice it, and I realized, no, you know what? Let him get away with it this time, because I can benefit a lot more if I collaborate with him than if I just continue to fight with him.
Or that we settle our difference through a third part, you know, like the government has, you know, monopoly on violence. So it has affected, you know, modernism is not only in architecture, it's in art, it's in every aspect of our, of, you know, the culture today, you know, the relativism, that there are no values, nothing is true, do what you want, do what you please. And this is also equally important. This is very much in architecture, not so maybe in the other field, or partly in the other fields, is that so that people shouldn't know that there is an option, they try as much as possible to destroy what was there before them. So you had, you know, especially in the 60s and the 70s, less so today, but still continuing, you had, you know, major destruction of classical cityscapes and towns, major destruction. So now we can look at photos and just, you know, wow, was it this beautiful? And you see today, but you know, it's much more real if you see, you know, a building in front of you and you see its neighbor is an ugly modernist building. And then, you know, your mind starts to think, you know, what the hell happened? Why, what happened to architecture? We are 100 times richer today than we were 100 years ago. But if you look at architecture, it looks like we are 1,000 times poorer. So it's like 1984, you know, rewrite the past, destroy the past. It has never happened. This is the only option.
My favorite example of this is, I use that in the Fiat standard, is the Public Library of Boston. It was built in 1895. And it cost, I have the numbers in the Fiat standard, so I may be off here, but it cost at that time, I think $1 million or $2 million. Today, in today's money, it's around I think 70 or 90. I forget the exact number. But that was the building that was built in 1895. And then in 1971, they built the new Boston Public Library right next to it. Essentially, the two buildings are right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And the new one is nicknamed the mausoleum. It looks like a grave. It's a big, giant box with little windows. And the astounding thing about it, and this is really why I focus on time preference as being the explanation for this, is that it's not cheaper. It's not just that it's not just uglier because, you know, we can't afford it anymore, or we're trying to build more libraries. So rather, you know, back then the library supposedly was for rich people because it looked nice. And now we're building libraries for poor people and we get to build more libraries from that. No, it's not cheaper. It's actually more expensive. In fact, the building that was built in 1971 required renovation in 2000, 2010 or something like that, and required several years of renovation that cost more in dollar terms than it cost to build the Boston Public Library in 1895. So it's not cheaper to build those things. It's just very high time preference. It's expensive in the long run. It's cheap today. You know, you put together a bunch of quick designs and you tell people this is beautiful. And if you disagree, then you just don't understand it. And it's cheap.
Or you're a Nazi. You're a Nazi. Yeah. That's also an argument they use. If you discuss architecture for more than 15 minutes and say that you prefer classical architecture, you will be called a white supremacist.
Yeah, which is
I promise.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But like, if the issue is cost, then it's definitely not the case that modern is cheaper, because modern requires a lot more renovation and a lot more maintenance, which ends up costing money. So This is why, in my opinion, I think it is the time preference. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's related to all of those things. But what do you think about the idea that it is the money that is the driver of those things? So the way that I see it, when money was gold, it was possible to maintain the value of your money. Money appreciated every year in real terms, in terms of real goods and services, by about 1% or 2%. So every year you could buy 1% more apples, 1% more houses. 2% more houses, because every year we're making more apples, more houses, more everything, whereas gold is the hardest thing to make. So the scarcity of gold over time means that its value grows. So I think in a world like that, your alternative to building a house is maintaining the money in your pocket. And so in order and the money maintaining its value. So in order for you to take that money out of your pocket and give it to an architect who's going to build you a house, that house better hold value as well, because otherwise, why would you give up with that money? Because the money that you have will hold on to its value. I think that's one way of looking at it. And then the other way is the money, the fact that now we move to a, from the flip side of this is, you know, when you move to the fiat world, now the money doesn't hold on to its value very well. And so therefore, your option of keeping the money in your pocket means that if you hold on to it for another 10 years or in the bank, you're going to lose, you know, depends on when and where you live, maybe 10%, 50%, maybe 99.999%, like the case in Lebanon. So in those places, the money is burning a hole in your pocket. So you're going to be a lot less discerning about where you invest it. Your money isn't expected to last 100 years. And so therefore, the house that you're going to spend it on doesn't have to also last 100 years. Mm-hmm. So it leads to this idea that back in the 19th century, people were building because they thought, you know, when you built a house for your family, you expected your grandkids and their grandkids maybe to live in it. Today, people build houses and you look at modern architecture, you see that basically it has a shelf life of maybe 20, 30, 40 years then, and then it's going to get taken down and get renovated.
Yeah, it's absolutely reasonable. It's absolutely reasonable. And by the way, your comment about Middle East, they are crazy about gold in the Middle East, and that may have had something to do with, you know, the lack of trust, you know, in money. And also, you know, real estate becomes real estate and not, you know, homes.
Yeah.
So everything is very, 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 you know, technical. Everything is very technical. Everything is, you know, we lost connection to it. And yes, gold is something that you can figure. It's something you can hold. It's something real. So yes, in that way, you have a better trust for, you know, the currency. Now we're disconnected from it. You know, when they left the gold standard, I think it was in the 40s or 50s, they did it in the British Empire, at least.
Well, arguably, I would say 1915, 1916. So after that, they were sort of saying that we are kind of on the gold standard and different things. But really, 1915 is when I think it went. They went off the gold standard.
So then it's part, you know, of a part, you know, there are many reasons for things to happen, but that's definitely a feasible, you know, a reasonable argument why all this changed. You know, short-term development, because I don't know if things will have value tomorrow, then I just want to make a quick buck now and don't care about the future. Yes, it definitely, you know, it holds water and it affects, you know, people's mindsets, how they think, how they build. Money now, because I don't know if I'll have it tomorrow. I don't know anything about the future and what future. We're all going to die anyway, you know, combined with secularization, we have fewer children today. So everything is more important now than a future that we simply trust less and less. Yeah. And we also, you know, because we don't believe in an afterlife, a majority of people, I would say, in the Western world don't believe in an afterlife anymore. We are very much here and now. It's everything's very much here and now. So there is, you know, lack of long-term thinking. But we have new religions in a way. You know, you have this climate change religion. I'm not arguing against climate change.
No, please go ahead. We argue against climate change here all the time.
But the way how it has become, it's a religion. It has nothing to do with science. So if we care about climate change, you know, when you build classical, a building has longer lifespan. And why does it have longer lifespan? Is it because of the materials? No, it's because buildings have value beyond mere function. So if you build this beautiful Boston, you know, they built the beautiful Boston Library, Central Library. And let's say in 100 years' time, let's say tomorrow that they would think, oh, we will move the entire library to another place. Then they will make an effort to repurpose this old beautiful building and use it in a different way. While the concrete one, they will not make an effort. They will sell it to a developer that will clear it down, tear it down, and they will build a new building. So in that way, the classical architecture, the classical tradition, you're building beauty and building buildings that have a culture, rich cultural expressions, they will be more eco-friendly. They have lesser impact, you know, CO2 emissions, because they will stand longer, because every generation would find reason to repurpose these buildings. If you look at it, I don't know the situation where you are situated, but I can tell for most of Europe and Stockholm, where I live, we repurpose old mills, you know, flour mills and warehouses and industry buildings, because they are so beautiful. So we make them to luxury apartments today.
Yeah.
Would anyone consider, you know, making a 1960s factory to luxury apartments? You know, that's preposterous. It's the same thing with this, you know, modernist library, the concrete box. No one will protest if it's torn down. So that is what will happen. But buildings that we are beautiful and rich in cultural expression, we will always try. We will not always succeed, but we will always try and make an effort to preserve them and find new function for them.
I remember in London once I was shown a very nice building, and I was told this actually used to be horse stables back in the day, and now it's a very nice building. And it's pretty astounding to think that 18th century horses lived in places where 21st century rich London investment bankers live today.
Sorry for interrupting, because that's a passion of that. But it's even worse, you know. We have jails now in Stockholm and in many other places. 19th century jails that they made to hotels. So it's crazy when you think of it.
It is.
But they are so, the structures are so beautiful. You know, they are not, you know, very derogative, they're richly decorated. They're not, you know, Art Nouveau masterpieces. But they are solid and beautiful brick buildings with towers, beautiful roofs, the proportions are right, the facade division. So they look marvelous in a simple way. So we make hotels of them. Any post-war prison, you know, would anyone even consider making repurpose to anything other? It will be torn down. And then for the people in the climate religion, that's a loss for the environment, because, you know, the biggest impact a building has on the environment is when it's built and later torn down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's, I very much agree with you that the climate religion is just completely irrational. It's a set of beliefs whose absurdity is the point. You know, it's like a humiliation ritual where you need to stand up there and actually be a grown adult who says, yes, I am scared because tiny, imperceptible, infinitely tiny little particles of CO2 are going to destroy this entire planet, because they're going to go from 320 particles per million to 420 parts per million over a couple of years.
I would argue that you know, we're changing the climate, but I'm arguing against, you know, the doomsday religion.
Yeah.
And, you know, the psychosis, you know, the mass psychosis, you know, all these young teenage girls that cry, that get angst, that can't sleep at night because the climate's going to kill us all in 5 years. You know, it's like a doomsday cult.
It is.
It really is. And how, you know, how, now I'm going to sound really communist, you know, how big corporations profit really much of this.
Absolutely.
They really do, you know, because I can only speak, you know, for the place where I live, but we sell, you know, cow's milk for one US dollar per liter. I don't know what that is in gallons, but $1 per liter. We sell, let's say havre, this, it's not wheat, but there's something that grows in colder regions that's similar to wheat. I forgot its name in English. And we sell it, you know, milk made of this, you know, like soy milk, but this is from this grain. So we sell this grain milk for double the price when it should be half the price, because there's no, you know, middle, there's no cow that needs to chew it and live and everything. You can process it directly. So it's so much this, you know, all this plant-based meat, all these plant-based things should be cheaper than, you know, the real meat and the real milk, but they are not, because they, you know, they reap havoc, you know, on this scared cultist, you know, crying people that really trying to find, you know, indulges.
Yeah.
So that they, you know, can come to heaven.
No, and absolutely, and the way that it has terrified people is just it's a religious replacement. It's exactly what Christianity used to do. People would be scared of the fact that there's a judgment day, that they'd live their life in fear of that. And I think the other thing is that religion allowed us a social focal point, really, where we all agree and that, you know, this is our religion, this is our God. And therefore, as a society, we gather around the idea of being as religious as possible, being as good in terms of the religion. So you want to give more charity, you want to go to church, you want to do all of those things that are part of the religious ritual.
Yeah, because it's social cohesion.
Exactly. Mm. And now that's been replaced by basically freaking out about the weather. And that's the new religion. And so it's the same thing. So, you know, your virtue signaling is, instead of helping with charity, now you donate to a bunch of Swedish teenagers like Greta, who are out there going to protest or doing whatever. You have a lot to answer for, Sweden, with Greta, but we'll let it pass.
I'm so sorry. You know, I'm sorry for my country. I'm only half Swedish. Only half of me needs to.
Everybody's got a lot to answer for in this world, unfortunately. But I also remember another example I've seen in Toronto. I've seen pictures of the, actually not just pictures, actually, it's still there, the new town hall, and then there's the old town hall next to it. And again, it's another great example of the contrast between the two. The new town hall is just another box, and the old one is just a beautiful building. And until today, tourists go visit the old one. Nobody goes to the new one. But in many places, they tore down the old one when it was functioning. There was no engineering or structural reason that required you to tear this down. But it got sold based on the idea that, look, it's the 1960s. We have all these amazing technology things, and we need a building that is modern. And so it got torn down, say, in the 60s and 70s. They tore these beautiful classical buildings down, replaced them with modernist eyesores. And today, the modernist eyesores need to be torn down, whereas the classical buildings that survived the 60s and 70s are still functioning and still going strong. I think my...
And they're high value.
And they're higher value. High value. Absolutely.
Yeah, that should also be stressed. Okay, the situation is different, you know, but in Europe, I would say, you know, the classical districts and the classical buildings, they are much more higher valued. You know, if you take everything equal, location and such, people will pay more for a classical, living in a classical apartment, you know, in a classical building, than in a modernist one.
Very true.
So it's, yeah.
Including modernist architects. This is a very common theme, yes, on the internet, where people will show you the architect, the buildings they built, and the building in which they live. And it's very common. You know, they build these glass and concrete boxes, but they go and live in 19th century townhouses.
Yeah. It's hilarious. It's really hilarious because I thought, you know, I first read about this in, of course, in Sweden, where I live, where our, you know, architecture magazine made a study, you know, where do Swedish architects live? And they were overwhelmingly, they lived in classical buildings. So it's like, what? And then you check, you know, the offices of all the big Swedish architecture firms. They are also all in classical buildings. And if you check this internationally, you know, in the UK, Norway, it's the same. It really is crazy, you know. So there is a Scottish sculptor that said it very well, you know, modernism is something you do to others. And it really is. And the scary part is that they don't see this hypocrisy. They really don't see it. You know, they had an interview with a German magazine called Der Spiegel, had an interview with this Dutch star architect called Rem Koolhaas, where they asked him, if architects would, you know, live in the buildings that they design, wouldn't they be more beautiful? And, you know, he said, oh, that's just shallow and stupid. It's not about that. So they actually did a good interview. So they stressed, you know, where do you live? And he lived, you know, in a Victorian apartment house in London. Yet he refuses to design anything like that. So the same people that overwhelmingly live in classical buildings, they refuse to design them. It's just, why? Why? Doesn't that say something? Don't you think that other people want the same thing as what you inhabit? And if it's so good that you refuse to live in, you know, in modernist buildings, isn't there something wrong with your ideology? It's an open goal, really. The more you talk about it, the more you show, you know, there is this fable, you know, the emperor is naked. And the emperor is really naked. And all we have to do now, thanks to the internet, we can expose it so easily.
Yeah, and I think the reality of it is that the vast majority of people, it's true, I think, with architecture and it's true with art, they know this, they feel it, but they're constantly really being gaslighted. That term gets used a lot, but I think in the case of architecture and art, it's a perfect application of it. We just have people who appoint themselves as experts and authorities on art and architecture, and they're constantly talking down to us about the fact that, no, you just don't understand. You know, Damien Hirst or whatever his name is puts a statue of the Virgin Mary in a jar full of piss, and you're supposed to applaud because that's art, you know. But if you make fun of Damien Hirst or one of those artists, then you're, you know, that's sacrilegious. So, you know, being sacrilegious towards Jesus or the Virgin Mary is cutting edge, revolutionary, amazing art. But being sacrilegious toward Damien Hirst or any of these modernist artists or architects is basically you are ignorant and you don't understand. But I think the internet has really helped us. Like, I think my book, The Bitcoin Standard, was a book on Bitcoin, and there were a couple of pages where I was discussing time preference and how it changed, and I went on a bit of a diatribe on modern art for a few pages, which I thought, you know, could serve as a good illustration because it's something very vivid. Everybody knows that what the Sistine Chapel looks like, and everybody has seen David Rothko's idiotic mattresses with basically 7-year-old scribbles on them. And like, there's a difference. You can't, if you get Rothko and you tell him to go and make the Sistine Chapel, he won't be able to do it. If you got Michelangelo and you told him, hey, can you just go and do the stupid bullshit that Rothko did, he's gonna spit in your face for degrading him enough to ask him to do something so much, because if he could, his little boy could do it.
Yeah, you needed real talent before, and today you need no talent, you need connections. And this is also, you know, you could say that modernist ideology is, I wouldn't say it's a religion, but more of an ideology that people have invested a lot in. So what you need is basically like an exit strategy. You can compare it, you know, to 1991 in Soviet Union. People wake up that have lived all their lives, you know, they've been party members and they really believed in communism. And then they wake up and they're told that everything they believed their entire lives was a lie. What do you do? Either you get depressed or you double down. So what architects do is and artists and all these crazy people is that they double down on the madness, because the truth will be so hurtful to everything that they have believed in, you know, their entire lives.
Yeah. I did get a lot of that reaction of a lot of people just, you know, getting so offended and outraged. Like, how could you say this about Rothko? No, you just don't understand. But I will say, I did get a lot of people who said, particularly artists, who said, this actually made me think and really changed the way that I approached art. In particular, a guy called Fractal Encrypt, he goes by that name. He's in the Bitcoin space. And he says basically that part of the chapter changed his life because, yeah, this was the issue. I think a part of it is talent, but I think a part of it is just basically turning up and doing the work. And I quote a passage from Michelangelo, you know, when he wrote a poem about making the Sistine Chapel. And it was 4 years of hanging from the ceiling and painting, and he describes all of the ailments that fell on him, you know, smelling the humid air and the paint and his bones and his neck and all of those problems that he got. It's very visual, the poem that he wrote. That's 4 years of really, really, really hard work. I guarantee you, David Rothko did not go through that kind of hard work to make his mattresses. And that's what it is. Like, it's with the same genetics that were there when Michelangelo were there are still around. So we probably have Michelangelos amongst us. It's just they have not spent their life working hard at perfecting their craft like Michelangelo did. You know, when he was a kid, he was out there going out with painters and architects and figuring out what they're doing and trying to copy them and learning and spending days and nights and weeks and months and years struggling and working hard to try and develop this so that he could make something so beautiful that people could look at and everybody would look and point and say beautiful without him having to harangue them and tell them, no, you're idiots. You don't understand. Like your work can speak for yourself if you put in the work.
Yeah. It's so true what you say, because, you know, when it comes to classical beauty, if you don't know anything about, you know, references, cultural history, you can still appreciate it. And if you know the things, you can appreciate it even more. But you point out to the tragedy of modern times. You know, never in the history of humankind has there been more talent wasted. Because how many human beings are we today? We were 8 billion, you know. World population during the time of Michelangelo was, what could it be? 1 billion, more, less than a billion, probably 800 million, something. And how many people today have access to higher education or education at all? So what we have in our time is that we have probably millions of potential Michelangelos, you know, in the global population that are totally wasted because there is no one that, you know, can harness their talent or lead their talent to something useful. So we could really be, you know, entering a golden age of architecture and art just because of the sheer amount of potential talent that we have today, but it's all wasted. So if you waste talent, there's no use for it. This is really a tragedy of modern times. And I know it for true in architecture schools. And what you get now is that you get a self-selection in architecture schools. Only people that like boxes and crazy figures will apply. If you have talent in drawing, if you have talent of creating, it's more likely that you will go into computer gaming and doing computer graphics than that you will become an architect. So the self-selection reinforces, you know, the downhill trend in architecture, because these new people that aspire to become architect, they are the one that likes the boxes, and then there are the future professors and architecture critics, and the system will be, you know, self-reinforcing for every generation. So I don't think you can fix it in architecture schools. You need to create completely new architecture schools. I don't want, you know, to remove the profession of architect or institutional learning. Just you cannot solve it in the established institution that has been totally hijacked. You need to create new schools, and there are new schools, but they are not mainstream in general. You know, there are classical art schools in both US and in Europe, There are several, but you know, in the big picture, they are of course just a tiny percentage of all art students. And when it comes to classical architecture, there's only one university in the entire world that teaches, you know, have a classical architects program.
Which one?
Notre Dame, the Catholic University of Notre Dame in the US, in Ohio, I think it's situated. There are, you know, other places where they have individual courses. There are places we have in Europe, we have summer schools in classical architecture for French speakers and English speakers, but we don't have like a full program where you study, you know, 5 years and then you become a licensed professional classical architect. So, yeah, things are changing, but they are changing a bit too slow in, you know, in the big picture, but the flame is kept alive at least. And that's important because we also have now a problem with a lot of loss of skills, you know, stone masons, you know, all these traditional skills that created all this beauty, they have hard to find apprentices. It's strange, you know, it's really a job for the future, you know, when we automatize everything, people can start working with their hands again. You know, when doing this craft thing, of course, we can let a robot or an AI do it. But I think it's better, you know, if we work with our hands, because then we get less alienated from what we're doing. But yeah, they have hard time finding, you know, new pupils that want to do this. So it's important to get more classical projects built to increase demand and create like a search and an interest for all these professions that are needed. Also, you know, it's not only an architect that needs to be people we know, different craftsman skill, a ton of them, different craftsman skill.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is where we see another parallel with economics. I think there's a very similar situation in economics. There's classical economics, which was dominant up until the early 20th century. And then when humanity decided to basically do the equivalent of sniffing glue, which is going on fiat money, that economics was replaced by the insane nonsense that you see today, where, you know, the governments just need to be printing money all the time and everybody thinks that's a good thing. Yeah, they're saving the bank. Thank God they're out there to save us, and nobody stops to question, why is it that we need to constantly be printing money to save the banks? Why does the world need more money? But we don't need more money. And it's impossible to ask these questions in university. I was at the PhD program in Columbia University, and when you ask this question of why should the money supply be increased in the first place? Why should there be a central bank out there printing more money? Why can't we just, you know, break the printer and have the money that is existing there, and then we just use that, and then its value goes up over time, so people who save are able to buy more and more, and that leads to more capital accumulation, leads to more wealth, leads to more economic growth, leads to more investment, leads to higher productivity. Why would we not want that? That's the whole point of economics. That's just an impossible question to answer. People just look at you like you're an alien, they laugh, they rationalize it with stupid thought substitutes they learn at university, where, you know, you just, as you said, guilt by association. Oh, so these are Austrians, so they must be Nazis. Forget the fact that yes. Mises was a Jew who fled Austria from the Nazis, but he gets called a Nazi anyway.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, but so, you know, these kind of thought substitutes, or it's just, or they're extremists, or it's old and it doesn't work in the modern economy. We have a very fast economy that doesn't work. Completely fallacious and easy to disprove arguments, but they're not meant to be argued. They're not meant to be thought about. They're just meant to protect you from thinking about the implications of what people are presenting, yes, as different ideas. But the alternative is thriving online, just like you're saying with architectures, just like what you guys are doing. It's just people are finding, you know, what I do with my website, I left my university job, I teach economics courses online, and, you know, people from all over the world are taking those courses because they realize there's something wrong with the economics that we took at university. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
What you touch is something that's very, you know, what's very acute in architecture, and now you mentioned it, that it's also part of economics, is that, you know, there's some kind of idiotic thinking that, you know, that equals man's technical progress with man's, you know, somehow spiritual progress. We are the same human beings as 100 years ago. We're exactly the same. But because, you know, all these people equal, you know, because we are more technically advanced today, we are somehow different humans. We are not. We are exactly the same humans. And with this thinking, you cannot learn from anything that was before you. Because how could we learn from these people that lived 100 years ago? They were more, you know, primitive than us. They see, you know, they equal technology with, you know, even spiritual thinking or you know, all kinds of thinking. So yeah, of course you cannot learn from people that lived before and learn about, you know, basic inflation, because now is new, now is somehow different. We are somehow different people than the ones that did before us. Never mind that our behaviors are exactly the same. Never mind that you can measure our behaviors in the exact same way, you know, with classic market economy and, you know, supply and demand. And then when it comes to money, if you increase supply, then it will not increase demand. It will only lower the value of money. So, yeah, I think it's, I hate to go into so much politics, but I have to touch politics. I think it's, much of this is part of, you know, the whole woke thinking that the past is bad. You cannot learn anything from the past. Because in the past, everyone was bigots and racist and sexist. You, what you do is that you, we have an expression in Swedish, you throw out the baby with the bathwater. So of course we should know, we should not wholeheartedly pick everything from the past. Not everything in the past was good, but you keep the good and you reject the bad. That's how you know humans evolve. That's how you learn. But now it's just a clear, like with architecture, a clear break with the past, because everything with the past was bad. And you're not allowed to read books from the past. It's dangerous, because then you can get ideas that are dangerous. Everything is dangerous. It's really, you know, yeah, it's used too often, but yeah, 1984 is really, you know, what I come to think of. Because the past is dangerous.
Yeah, and it's interesting how selectively this thing is applied. So everything from the 19th century is bad, except, of course, you know, semi-literate morons like Karl Marx or stuff is okay. You know, all of the nasty things he said about black people and about Jewish people and about all of those racist things that he said just completely get washed away. It's fine. All of his sins are excused because
yes.
It's the high time preference ideology of the present. It's just this idea that you don't need to do anything. Marx basically never worked, never took care of himself, never washed.
Of course
and,
not.
So he's
he let his wife support him.
Yeah, his
that's
wife
sexist and or something.
And Engels, who was a rich man, he supported him as well. And he had a slave in his home who he didn't pay, and he got her pregnant, and he covered up and he made Engels pretend to be the father of the child. And two of his children died young from neglect, basically, because he didn't care for his children. This is that guy's okay to read. That's one guy from the past that's okay to read today. But, you know, don't go and read crazy stuff like how to make a building nice for people. That's too extremist.
Or just reading about, you know, classical economics and question why. Because it's also the same people, as you know, that forbid you from learning from the past. They are very authoritarian in the way that they are, you know, expert worship. You know, if someone is an expert or labeled an expert, we should slavishly follow every instruction. We should obedient believe everything that that person say. We should, you know, never question. We should remove our own thinking, our own judgment, and we should blindly believe. And what they miss is that experts are humans and humans can error, and also that experts change their minds. And the third is that experts have, like all of humans, have a political agenda. So what experts believe align very much, you know, what their political beliefs are. So if you're a right-wing economist, you will believe in certain things. And if you're a left-wing economist, you will believe in certain things, regardless of reality, more or less. So one should never, you know, blindly follow experts. But today, yeah, the expert cult is stronger than ever, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a fundamental part of the fiat world, in that everything in the fiat world, and the way that I discuss it in the fiat standard, is that essentially you can think of fiat as a software for denying reality and trying to impose a reality by fiat. So, well, the government has a money printer, so the government can't do anything. And, you know, we're not too far away from the point where somebody's going to say, hey, you know, the government should just make the day 12 hours every day and just make sunshine. Because we have a money printer. We can do it. I mean, they're trying to fix the weather with printing money. surely they're going to next, you know, they're going to want to fix the tilt of the earth next. Why not? You know, if we can print money, we can do whatever we want. There's an infinite amount of resources. That's the basic idea that motivates everything. And so because you have this money printer that can print everything, on the one hand, I think these are the two dynamics of the fiat world. On the one hand, you can't save. So you are unable to provide for the future. So you start discounting the future. So you don't think of the future. On the other hand, the flip side of this coin is that where are your savings going? Why can't you save? Why does your money suck? Why does your money fall apart and lose its value? Because all of that energy is being harvested by the people who print the money. So those people have infinite power. People in government can't just dictate reality. They can make reality what they want it to be. And the way that they can do that is through money printing. And so you have this, you know, on the one hand, we are becoming high time preference. We don't think about the future. We don't prioritize for the future. On the other hand, we want to indulge ourselves because we have this completely supernatural power, you know, among us, which is the money printer, which can do whatever we want. And so it's just a wishing well, you know. Hey, we should not have sick children, so let's just print money and build hospitals, and then that should make sick children go away. And then if sick children are still sick, then clearly we need to vote harder and build more hospitals. You know, and you see it everywhere. You see it in terms of just the fact that we can use this to define reality. So what becomes food is now defined by government. Government issues, yes, dictate that tells people, hey, you should be eating this and you should be eating that. And, you know, as if humans had never been able to eat before government was giving them out advice. It's just a complete infantilization of people because people lose the ability to think long term. So they become like children and that, you know, it's just me, me, me.
And they get dependent.
And they become dependent, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So this dependence is, you know, the preposterous thing. You know, I know that you use the term marry the state, but it is really is marrying the state, you know, in the highest regard, because people lose all their initiative. They don't care about reality. They only care what is perceived as told to them, what is reality, because there is it's associated with high social costs to question, you know, reality. And everything is groupthink, and everything is violent, and everything's hanging with a threat of social exclusion if you question things. It's a very scary society, and we are moving there faster than one think. And it's also sad, you know, because what this tells you, what is the future of democracy? You know, created consent. We see it all the time. There is this meme on the internet, you know, I support the current thing. But it really is, you know, you see people, they have how many coronavirus shots they had, they put it. And now they put Ukraine flag. Of course, I support Ukraine. The difference to 99% of people, I've been to Ukraine also quite recently even. But, you know, they don't know anything. It's just I support the current thing. And the government can lead them to look at everything that they want. And they will blindly follow. They will never question. And now it is Ukraine. Tomorrow, before it was Corona, now it is Ukraine. Then tomorrow it will be something else. And no one ever questions. It just becomes one, you know, fanatic cult after another. And if you question, you are heretic and you should be socially ostracized.
Yeah.
Is that democracy? Is that the future of democracy? It's very scary when you think of it.
It is democracy. You know, I think people just have this idea that democracy is just everything nice is democracy. And then every time they see something they don't like, they think, oh my God, this can't be democracy. But no, that is democracy. Democracy just means 50% plus one can do whatever they want. So if 51% of a country decide to murder 49% of the country, that's democracy. Yeah. All the good things that people associate with democracy are essentially orthogonal to democracy. They're not related to what democracy. So they like liberal democracy, which means there's freedom of speech, which means there's freedom of belief, all of these nice things.
Rule of law,
all of those things. None of that has anything to do with democracy specifically, which is 51% get their way. In fact, I think if the 20th century has taught us something, I would argue democracy has been far less liberal than monarchies. You look all over the world, you see many examples of countries that are very similar culturally, religiously, ethnically. And, you know, one of them was kept their monarch, and then the other one went down the path of democracy and revolution. And then, of course, it ends up with despotism and authoritarianism. And people just say, oh, well, that's not real democracy. And never mind the fact that it always goes in that direction, but that's what it is. And I think people mistake the advertising that comes with democracy, which is all of these liberal ideals, for democracy. But really, if you are for liberal ideas, I don't think the ballot box is the way to get them. I think personally, for me, the most important technology for democracy, for liberalism, for freedom, for individual freedom and sovereignty, and for living in a civilized society in which people get to believe what they want and think what they want, is Bitcoin, because it takes away the money printer. That's what it comes down to. Because if Bitcoin becomes widely adopted as money, governments won't be able to print it. They won't be able to print their own money. And then we go back to the normal world. We go back to reality. We have to deal with reality as it is. And we can't just keep mandating reality by fiat because we have a money printer.
Yeah. But are you connecting the Bitcoin to gold standard then?
Yeah, essentially, the way that I see it is basically Bitcoin is the advanced form of gold, in that the problem with gold, the reason that gold failed effectively and the reason that governments were able to replace it with their scam coins, if you want, you know, the fiat money, is because ultimately gold needs to be moved around expensively. And therefore, it's expensive to move. Because it's expensive to move it around, it tends to centralize. Eventually, you know, everywhere in the world, gold flowed into banks and people started using pieces of paper rather than the gold. And then they started using letters of credit and checks and all kinds of different instruments, wherein you don't actually physically move gold when you pay. So, you know, in Sweden, if you're trying to buy something from England in the late 19th century, you know, you say you buy something for 3 ounces of gold, they're not going to send 3 ounces of gold every time somebody buys something from Sweden to England. There's a bank in Sweden, there's a bank in England, and at the end of the day or week or month or year, they tally up all the money that they were sending to one another, and then they balance the books. They make one shipment. So at the end of the year, you know, we cross it all out, and then there's one shipment. So effectively, gold just becomes centralized because of that. And then because it becomes centralized, if you manage to take over the institution where the gold is centralized, you take over all of the world. And that's effectively what happened in the 20th century. And Bitcoin basically gets around that. Bitcoin is designed specifically to get around that, because the whole point of Bitcoin's design, you know, a lot of people struggle with understanding Bitcoin because they get into the how without understanding the why. And if you look at the how without understanding the why, it's extremely confusing. It's like walking into an extremely specific building, if I were to give you an architecture metaphor, and you're trying to understand why did they put all of these things here? You know, if you don't know the purpose of the building, like this is supposed to be, say, a stadium or something very specific, then you won't, none of it would make sense. Like if you think of it as a house, why would this house look like this? And then you understand, oh, well, this is serving this specific function. So in the case of Bitcoin, in the case of the architecture of Bitcoin, the function that it serves is the ability for you to hold your money and send it without anybody being able to stop you from sending it, without anybody being able to confiscate it, and perhaps most importantly, without anybody being able to print more of it. That's the killer app of Bitcoin. There's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin. And so that, for me, is bringing back the property of gold that made gold money, which is the fact that you can't make more of it, but improving on it. Because with gold, every year you make 1% or 2%. Bitcoin, you currently make around 1% or 2%. But it's going to go down eventually, and it's going to drop to about 0%. And the other aspect, which is even more important functionally, is that you can make millions of transactions on Bitcoin daily without having to go through a central bank. And that, I think, is enormously powerful. I think it's why it's going to be much more difficult for governments to capture Bitcoin like gold. And that's why I think it's a truly, truly world-changing technology. It's up there with the printing press and the internet and writing, in that if it takes away the government's money printers, it's going to make the world a very, very different place.
Honestly, I need to read, of course, more about this, but it sounds beautiful, because centralization of power is a problem, because power always wants to grow. Of course, I mentioned examples that I can relate to, because I live in Europe. We have the problem with the European Union, that it always wants to grow. Because once they got power, the power wants to centralize more, grow more, because all the bureaucrats, of course, want more power. They want more staff. They want more things to say about. So a decentralization, you know, is, you know, like a counter move. So if this means decentralization, then you know, I'm all for it, because concentration of power is always bad. And we see it in so many fields. When we're talking about democracy and freedom, now we have, you know, concentration of search engine. there used to be many search engines. Now we don't even say you search on the internet. We say Google. So Google basically has, what is 90%, except for China, I think, you know, Google has 90% of the market. So Google doesn't need to lie. Google just decide what we see when we search. And you and me and 99% of other people will click on the three most important, you know, links, the three first, you know, search results we will click on. So we have enormous concentrations of power, yes. So if this means decentralization, I'm all for it. Really, really all for it. And that's a way to save democracy as well.
Well, maybe we'll disagree on that one. For me, it's the way to free us from democracy. In fact, one of my more controversial ideas, and I have a lot of controversial ideas, but one of them is that Bitcoin is going to bring back monarchies, because I think monarchies are the only governments that are able to think of the long term, that are able to plan for the long term and think about the long term. I think we're going to get to a point where, you know, the governments that are run by democracies are going to be in constantly prioritizing the present, so constantly going toward inflation, and they're going to not prioritize holding Bitcoin for the long term. And so if their financial situation is going to disintegrate. Whereas I think monarchies, which, you know, have been in power for hundreds of years, the only reason they managed to stay in power for hundreds of years is obviously that they're doing something right. And that right thing that they're doing is, you know, thinking about the long term, thinking about how to make society better for the long term. So I think it might not be a solution for democracy, or it is a solution one way or the other, but maybe not the one that you want.
No, don't worry about provocational ideas. I'm full of them, and I am not woke, so I can listen to all kinds of ideas. I have no problem with that.
And also, you live in a monarchy. Yeah. You benefit from being in a monarchy.
I benefit from living in a monarchy. I can agree that monarchy has its advantages, and I will tell you one, because my major interest is social anthropology, and when it comes to countries, especially multi-ethnic one, you cannot have, you know, modern day nation states and nationalism. You need a unifying figure. So either it will be a very strong religious society where religion will be the common determinator, you know, uniting different peoples, or there will be a monarch. In the case of Europe, you know, before World War I, it was the monarch that unified, you know, empires that consisted of many different peoples. And you have it even, you know, today in the other parts of the world, we have, you know, the case of Iran. Iran is a very multi-ethnic state. The only thing that can keep it together is either a monarch, the Shah, or as now, you know, an Ayatollah, because you cannot appeal to, you know, democracy or nationalism. It won't work there, because then it will, you know, be torn down in, you know, ethnic conflict. So you need like a unifying figure, and a monarch is, you know, either a monarch or a mullah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In the case.
And I think, you know, to look around the Middle East, another argument I make is, you know, you look around today, in fact, very few people like to make this observation, but the starkness, particularly in Arab countries, the stark difference today between the fate of countries that stayed as monarchies versus countries that became republic is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And just inflation on its own. I did a comparison between the exchange rate of these of Arab countries over the past 50 years compared to the US dollars. And it's amazing. All of the monarchies had lower inflation than all of the republics. It's just clear cut. Like, you look at all of the devaluation, all of them, all of the monarchies had very little devaluation compared to the dollar, and all of the republics destroyed their currency. And you're talking about very similar countries. You know, you're talking about Syria and Jordan, Morocco and Algeria. These are very similar countries in many, many ways. And yeah, I think
one was monarchy and one was republic. Yes. So it's it's long term. Yeah, it's what you mentioned, long term thinking between short term, you know, popularity gains. So
yeah. Well, we're drifting away a little bit from architecture, but I want to get back to that, because that's why we've got you here. And I want to get more of your knowledge. So you did mention that classical is beauty, but I think there is a misconception here that it is beauty for the sake of beauty's sake, that is almost like ornamentation. And this is kind of where some of the criticism of classical architecture and some of the defense of modernist architecture might seem to make a lot of sense. And I think this is kind of how I thought of it up to a point, which is, look, yeah, it looks nice, but you know, back in the day, they were building for nice things. Now we live in a more rational world, and so we're building for function. And so, yeah, it would be nice if, say, old Toronto or old Stockholm, if today's Stockholm was all like the old Stockholm or Toronto, but it would mean a lot fewer people being in the same area, which means a smaller city, which means smaller opportunity for economic development and economic growth. And so these cans of sardines of buildings that have people in tiny little apartments, they may not be very nice for the architectural snobs like you, but you know, they make a lot of people able to live in that city, and they mean a lot more vigorous labor market, I guess. I'm trying to remember what his name was, but there was a French economist and architect who spoke about cities essentially being labor markets. And the reason that a city is such a powerful place is that if you have 5 million people in one place, then you've got enormous opportunities as a worker, and you can specialize. And the bigger the population that can fit into a small area, the more the economies of scale in the production of everything. And so that's why cities are the pioneers in industry, technology, and culture and everything. It's because we can fit a lot of people together, and so the magic happens. So what is your response to that? So, you know, okay, maybe it's prettier.
Many classical responses, and it's a very good question. First of all, it's very reductive view of classical architecture that, you know, everything is just, you know, beauty because it's nice. It's, you know, it's reducing it to just a matter of style, not an architecture philosophy. You know, all these stylistic elements, they bear value to us. They are part of who we are. You know, they are references to the past, you know, yes, to the Greek or Roman past, and also to mythology, different aspects of our culture, and they fuse the old with the new. So you have, you know, in Art Deco ornamentation, you have things that, you know, the high hopes of the 30s. In the 30s, there was depression, so they had high hopes of the combustion engine, you know, of airplanes and such would bring wealth to you and peace to humanity. Okay, it didn't end that way, but at least that's how they, you know, they decorated their buildings, because, you know, they used both classical stylistic motifs and they used new ones, you know, the new hopes for society. So it's basic culture. Then when it comes to building high and you know, pack as many people as possible, that's also a very reductive view of what it means to be a human being. And it has been done with disastrous results. You know, there's a lot of news now of, you know, China and South Korea having, you know, record low birth rates. And most developed countries have, you know, below replacement fertility, but there is, you know, grades in hell. And when it comes to China and South Korea, it really is abysmal. And that's because, you know, they jam pack all these people in 40 story high rises. And they are not good ways for people, you know, to learn to get to know their neighbors. They are not good, you know, to get connected to the street. And they're in such case also, they lead to more depression and they depress fertility rates. So it's very short term, you know, it's like a combustion engine, you know, you throw in coal and you have no new coal left. It always constantly need new coal. But what happens when we run out of coal? Then we have nothing, you know, to fuel this economy with. And that's what happened now in China and South Korea. You built these high rises and you sterilize the whole of society. Then also, you don't need high rises to create density. And density also, there is nothing that, you know, the more density, the better. That's not the case. There is, you know, there can be too low density, but there can also be too high density. Cairo is not, you know, preferable human habitat. So what you want is good density, livable density. And the better you make the city, the more beautiful you make the city, the more interesting you make the city, the greener you make the city, the higher the density. And of course, traditional virtues, of course, you know, like rule of law, reduction of crime, the more density you can have in a city. And you can achieve this very excellent density with maximum 6-story buildings. You don't need tall skyscrapers. The most important thing to achieve good density is a good grid. So they often use Paris as an example, but you can use Paris, you can use Barcelona, you can use downtown Stockholm, you can use Berlin. They have all very good densities, very livable densities and high densities without having skyscrapers. Most buildings are 6 stories tall. They are, you know, concentrated around a courtyard. And in this courtyard, every citizen has, you know, every resident of this block has like a private, calm island, you know, in the bustling city. It's a very, very livable and very, very human form of urbanity and of density, and something that we should develop and you create, you know, make even better. So you don't need high rises for density. Of course, it's easier for a developer to build a high rise than to build a quarter block. You know, it's one structure and you make it high, you know, it's easy, but it's not good for society and it's not good for economy, because the economic aspect is also important to address. When you build these high rise places, you get a concentration of the economy to malls, to shopping malls. That means that small firms, you know, if you're outside this mall, you will get no visitors, because people will, you know, they will just walk to the mall, and everything they will need, they will find there.
They will drive to the mall and walk around in the mall.
So only the big firms will have the money, you know, because there's only one prime location. Only the big firms, they will crowd out all the small firms because they can be there. And that's bad for economic activity and economic development, because, you know, to create a big firm, you begin as a small firm. If you have the classical city with the classical grid, like Paris, like Stockholm, you get a more even spread in the, you know, in the city, like compared to a high-rise city. So you get many, many millions of good addresses and good places and good locations. And you get very interesting mix of plots. And some plots are not interesting for a big firm, like a small corner plot. But that's maybe excellent for a small store, like a, what you call it in English, you know, mom and pop stores. And if this has something good to offer, you know, people will naturally pass it by coincidence, because there's not one center. There are many centers. The whole city center is a center. People will naturally pass it by. Some will look at the store window and say, oh, this is interesting. You know, most consumption is, we don't know everything we want, but when we walk by and we see something, we will know if we want it or not. So it's very much dependent on chance. And the, you know, that the classical grid creates so many, you know, opportunities and chances for us, you know, to be exposed to new things. So we're exposed to this, and if this if this store goes well, it can grow to a big business, and then it will become a new chain. So for, you know, for the economic, you know, the economic destruction and creation, a good grid, a good classical grid instead of shopping mall culture is excellent, you know, it's an excellent ground for new businesses to develop. And also just for small businesses to thrive. Maybe not every, you know, small business over have the goal of becoming, you know, a big chain. Maybe they just want to go around. Maybe they like, you know, their personal take with their clients, and the clients like them as well. Maybe it's just a way of living. And now they have the possibility, because they will naturally get customers, you know, passerbys. So that's my take, you know, on both density and, you know, the whole urban form, you know, not high rises. High rises are bad for so many things. You know, every social study points out that high rises are bad. Kids that live in high rises are outdoor much less. And especially now, you know, with the smartphones and PlayStations, it's extremely important, you know, to make kids be more outside. Also, it alienates people. There are no too many people in a high rise. So people don't, it gets, you know, anonymous. People are alienated from neighbors. You knew very, very much fewer people in a high rise than you do in a low, how say, low rise set. So it's bad for our sociality, and it's bad for us as human. And as in the case, you know, they did studies, I mentioned fertility rates previously, but they made a study now in the US, you know, the number of kids you have depending on the dwelling that you live in. Of course, they haven't discussed, you know, if casual or if this correlation. But what they found out was that, you know, the more units per building, there is a correlation, especially after, I think, after 4, 5, or 6 units per building, the lower the fertility rates gets. And of course, there's both causation and correlation, and which one is the strongest, I don't know. But it just feels, intuitively, it feels very true when you see, you know, the fertility rates of all these mega cities that is popping up in the world, especially East Asian ones.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, I asked the question, but I think I have also my own view, which kind of agrees with you. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, one important point here is that people look at the big building and they think, well, look, you know, that's 80 floors and that fits 500 apartments, and that can fit a lot more than what you would fit in this one building. Like the footprint of that building would fit, say, 15 houses if you built up to two floors or six floors or something like that. But if you get to 80 floors, you can fit 10 times that. But what they don't see is that those people aren't going to spend all of their life stuck in their little apartment. Although who knows, you know, the way things are going with lockdowns and the Great Reset, maybe that's that is the future. But until now, you know, we still have the ability to leave our homes and we can still afford cars and gasoline, or at least many people can. And so these people need to go to work. These people need to go out, need to go to activities. And so the result is, you know, then you have a big movement every morning at 9 a.m. Everybody needs to leave all of these giant towers where they live to go into the giant towers where they work. And that requires an enormous amount of roads. And that is what eats up the street density. And so you were mentioning the example of Stockholm and Barcelona. Their population density is higher than the population density of New York. They don't have the same skyscrapers that New York has, but they don't have as many roads as New York has. And so you end up fitting more people into a smaller piece of land, into the same piece of land, into the same square kilometer per se, let's say. And these people aren't stuck in giant apartments where they just, you know, you don't get to see others. Your apartments are locked off from one another. You don't get to walk around. There are no streets. I think this is really the biggest problem in the U.S., in the cities of the U.S., is there's no pedestrian culture in most cities, most areas of most cities, because it's all buildings, and then there's all these roads that you need where to get around. And so as a result of this, people end up with actually pretty low density. And because of the traffic, which is essentially a problem that people always think they can solve, but it is an unsolvable problem. You can't have the entire town decide to go somewhere at 9 a.m. Everybody needs to leave and be in their office at 9 a.m. You basically need to tear down the half the town and turn it into roads at 9 a.m. so that everybody can go in quickly and then get it back together. And that's just obviously impossible. But the reason is you need roads for all of these buildings. And that just ends up taking up more and more space and ends up turning the city into isolated islands. Every little block is basically an island surrounded by highways and very big streets that have a lot of cars and trucks, and basically makes the distance much larger. In fact, defeating the entire point of the city, making the commute take longer. And so therefore defeating the entire point of the city. The whole point was that you wanted to be close to people. So I think, yeah, you could get more density in a place like Stockholm and Barcelona precisely because you don't have these large structures that require these massive roads. So a lot of people walk to work. A lot of people, as you said, you know, have those little small mom and pop shops. Interestingly enough, you know, as with the architecture, also in terms of urban design, this is where people like to go for their vacations. This is where people like to travel. You know, people go to Florence and see the beauty of Florence and post pictures of Florence a lot more than they go to your average modern skyscraper city. I mean, there's a novelty aspect if you've never been to Dubai. Yeah, it is actually sort of breathtaking when you see.
It's cool.
Buildings.
You know, it's an adjective that you know, the only adjective you can use for modernism is that it looks cool. But, you know, this attribute age very badly, you know, both with clothes and with architecture, the attribute cool age badly. So, yeah, I can agree it looks cool, and it looks cool from a distance. When you sit in your car in Dubai and you look at all the skyscrapers from a distance, it looks cool. But on a ground level, is it that cool? Is it that nice? Is it nice, you know, to walk around with it? I haven't been to Dubai, but I would, you know, doubt it. My experience with skyscraper is always that they look cool from a distance, and then you get close to it, and then it's just a big sterile plaza in front of them. There's nothing interesting. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing interesting happening on ground level. And yeah, there is a big problem with urbanism in the US. There is a big problem with urbanism in Europe as well. Our problem is that we don't build new classical neighborhoods. So yeah, we're getting extreme high concentration now in our downtowns. Everything, you know, everything's hyper gentrified as well. There is in downtown Stockholm, there is no normal people now in downtown Stockholm. Everyone is, you know, upper middle income. And it gets more crazy because you don't build new classical neighborhoods. What is, you know, defined as the city can, of course, expand. You just add new neighborhoods, like, you know, how the old neighborhoods came to be at once. But because we don't build new neighborhoods, the classical ones that exist get overpriced. And then there's complaint about gentrification. And, you know, it also becomes a chirification in a way that, as you mentioned, people want to recreate in the beautiful places. People don't recreate in the suburbs of Stockholm. They go to downtown. So we're like four times as many people as we were 100 years ago, but downtown hasn't changed in size. So it's getting, you know, crazier and crazier, especially, yes, rush hour is also hell in Stockholm because there are so many people, you know, crowding everywhere because downtown will not allow to grow. And you mentioned also this about tourism, which also makes everything so absurd because every tourist board in every city in the world seem to understand what people like. You know, I was in Ottawa in January and lovely people, but the city is a catastrophe. It's so ugly. It's so ugly and it's so alienating. But when you look, and most is, you know, they build a lot of strange, ugly modernist towers now in central Ottawa. They really destroyed their city. But if you look at the, you know, the movie of the tourist would visit Ottawa, you will hardly see any modernist buildings. They will show the parliament and they will show, you know, some remnants of like a classical market that they have in Ottawa. And then they'll show inside of some museums. It's like, okay, if this is Ottawa and if you look at visit Stockholm or visit Oslo, visit Berlin, visit London, it will always be the same thing. They show the classical buildings and almost never, or a minority of what they show will be modernist buildings. So then if they, you know, beauty cannot be that subjective if everyone knows what is beautiful and what is ugly.
Absolutely. This is the remarkable thing. Like you see this tourists, locals, foreigners, people from all over the world, when they go to these cities, they know where to go and look for the places they want to take their photos.
Mm. Yes.
They take their pictures in those nice places. And it's it's cross-cultural. It's cross-cultural. You know, when people from Asia go to Europe, these are the parts that they like. But also when people from Europe go to Asia, these are also the parts that they like.
And this is how we discussed, you know, because we have, of course, idiots in all places. We have idiots in Stockholm that, oh, we must build high rises. And I ask, you know, thinking about, you know, now we are so, you know, postmodern, we should think about our global brand. Never mind, you know, if we Stockholmers don't like, you know, high rises, that's one thing. But you can convince people at least with, you know, talking about a global brand. If you come from the US or from Asia, do you want to see a skyscraper city? Is that what you came for when you came to Europe? No, you want to see, you know, the beautiful turn of the century city. That's our brand, not, you know, high rises that they have more of where they came from, that are also probably taller and more impressive than the ones they come to see here. So if one should care about one's global brand, what makes business attractive, what makes people attracted to a certain place, that is what makes this place special. And just building, you know, new high rises in Stockholm because we must have it because everyone else have it, it's just, you know, bad in economic sense.
Yeah, it's bad in economic sense. And I think another major point, which I was getting at earlier, and then I got diverted talking about something else, is remember when we were talking about the destruction and demolition of old buildings to replace them with new ones? Yeah. I think perhaps a driver of that is the fact that governments are the ones building it. And for you and me, as people who live in the city, and, you know, let's say you live in Stockholm for generations and you hope that your children and their children will live there for generations, what you want from a city is different from the, you know, your cost benefit analysis of whether we should tear this thing down is different from the cost benefit analysis of a government official who has access to a money printer. Because in his case, if we keep the old beautiful town hall, which, you know, the tourists loves and the locals love, and it doesn't cost a lot to renovate, that means I don't get to print money. But if I say, hey, you know, the old town hall, it's old and it's not cool, and we need to get our city into the 20th or 21st century, and we need to keep up with the competitors, look at the city down the river, they built a new fancy tower. Why don't we build a new modern city hall that, you know, allows us to have all of the modern things that we need for a modern city hall, you know, as if you can't put a computer into an old building. But, you know, that becomes a lot more appealing as a logic for you if you have access to a money printer, because then you're just looking for an excuse to use the money printer, and tearing down the old town hall and replacing it with a new one is a great excuse. So you get to decide, okay, well, we are going to tear down the old city hall and we're going to build a new one. Now you get to decide who gets the contract.
Yes,
now you
exactly.
get to take all of the money. You get to become kingmaker, basically. All the biggest construction companies in the town want to be your friend, and they're going to contribute to your campaign. And I think a big part of the drivers of those things, the reason that we invest in those things, is because destroying the money, taking the money out of the hands of the free market, taking the money out of people's hands, and taking the value of money out of people's savings results in transferring that money to bureaucrats, and bureaucrats have a high time preference and an incentive to satisfy themselves now. You know, for I'm only going to be mayor of Stockholm for 5 years, and during those 5 years, I want to make as many favors as I can to as many rich and powerful people in the country. And I'm going to try and abuse the money printer and abuse government funding as much as I can by coming up with all these reasons for why the government needs to give us more and more money.
And then I become a consultant for all these companies that I made favors for. So.
Exactly. So what works for you because of fiat money as a bureaucrat does not necessarily work for the citizens of the city. There's an incentive problem there.
Incentive problem is very, very good, because that's, you know, one strategy to get things right, to create the right incentives. So then, you know, you should make it so the incentives work in the favor of the citizens. And if, you know, if Bitcoin does that, then I'm all for it. I have hard, you know, to comment it, you know, because I know of Bitcoin, of course, and I read some about Bitcoin, but I'm not into it. I'm what you would say, average Joe. You have a special knowledge about Bitcoin as much as I have special knowledge about, you know, architecture and you know, modernist ideology and such. And it highlights actually one of the problems with the modern world is that everything is so complex. So we rely on the experts all the time. Oh, they know better. And I as long as it, you know, works, I don't invest time in it. Because investing time takes away, you know, from my daily life. So you succeed in highlighting another problem of the modern world, you know, time preferences, you know, taking time, because what you are doing is more or less a revolution, and making people like me taking the time to learn more about it. That's the hard part, I would say. To make me move from, you know, the established routine. I put my money in, you know, regular
Although I'll tell you this. I mean, I wrote a book about Bitcoin, and I'm constantly talking about Bitcoin and have a podcast on Bitcoin, but I don't think of myself as an evangelist for Bitcoin. I'm not out there to try and convert people. I do this as a job. I used to be a university professor, and I started, I write about economics, and then I studied Bitcoin. I became good at writing about it, and now I do it as a job. But I'm not the sort of person who's going out there trying to convince people to get into Bitcoin, because I think, on the one hand, you know, if Bitcoin needed me to go around preaching, then it's probably doomed, and it's probably not worth my time. And secondly, the real marketing, the real heavy lifting for Bitcoin marketing is not done by me. It's done by Bitcoin's price, and it's done by the value of fiat money. So it's, as you may notice, your monetary system is not working very well. Yesterday was a Sunday in which all of the central banks got together and decided to issue a statement saying everything is fine, which historically, you know, these Sunday night statements are a very, very good red flag to suggest that things are not fine. So, you know, more and more people are witnessing their wealth evaporate in banks, in bonds, and in saving accounts and all of that stuff. And they're beginning to ask questions. And I think that's what's going to do the heavy lifting for Bitcoin. And I think, you know, realistically, though, you're not an expert in Bitcoin. You haven't studied how it works, but you're also not an expert in fiat money. And I've written a book on fiat money and Bitcoin. And I will tell you, fiat money is a lot more complicated. Mm. Bitcoin is software at the end of the day. Mm. Like you can audit the thing all the way down. You can go over it. You can see everything about how it works. Try and do the same thing with the Swedish central bank. Go see how they work. You know, just walk into their building one day. I'm going to guess they've moved to a modernist eyesore, no? Or are they still in their
eyesore? Oh, yeah, they moved to a modernist eyesore. They did.
Yeah, of course. They deserve to. Yeah. They deserve to.
Yeah, they deserve to.
They deserve a nice building.
And the square where they are situated, it used to be such a beautiful square. It's one of the most beautiful squares in Stockholm. And they tore everything down and they built this brutalist, horrible buildings. And today, of course, it's totally dead square. And there used to be, of course, prostitutes there. Now they cleared away the prostitutes, but it's still not a, you know, it's not a live square because everything is so ugly around it.
Well, the arguably not cleared away the prostitutes entirely. They just replaced them with different kinds. Yeah. I think it's a much more complicated and sophisticated system there in that all of these really weird ways of operating and that you're not supposed to know about and that they openly say that it is our job to manage expectations and to tell people things so that we can raise their confidence about them. It's ridiculous voodoo.
You are not allowed to question. So.
Yeah, you're not allowed to question. You know, you don't get to vote and it's not clear if it's a government agency or if it's a private entity, but you know what's clear is that it's none of your business and you just take the money and use it and do what they tell you and thank them. But I think that's clearly not working and Bitcoin is just an alternative. So Bitcoin, without getting too deep into how it works under the hood, ultimately is just out there. It's just like the euro and the dollar and the kroner, I think it's called in Sweden. Is that what your money is called?
Yes.
Kroner, yeah. It's just another one of these currencies. It works differently under the hood from all of them. But over time, I think what's going to win for the reason Bitcoin wins is not because of people preaching it. It's because it's better technology. You know, the steam engine did not win because it had good marketing. It won because it's a lot more productive than the alternatives. Yeah.
And that's how classical wins as well, especially now, you know, because we have a more or less every Western country relies on immigration for population growth. As soon as you have, you know, declining population, like you had in Berlin and some German cities, then it's not fun for developers to build modernism. Then they start building classical because if people should, you know, if there's an abundance of apartments, then of course, you know, they will choose the more beautiful ones. We saw this in Sweden in the 90s, and we will see this much more, you know, in the future when, you know, classical would be clearly be profit maximizing for developers. Then it will win.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think my optimism when it comes to Bitcoin is that it undermines the deeper incentives economically that lead us toward this place. And that take away the city mayor with access to the government money printer, being able to decide, let's tear down this beautiful square to build a new modernist thing. Take away that guy, take away his money printer, and suddenly the people who become mayor are going to become a lot more reasonable about what they have as ideas, you know? Mm-hmm. And the new buildings that are going to be built are not going to be built with the perspective of, hey, let's get something flashy so that we get featured in magazines and CNN does a feature about how this building has a part of it that goes around and twists. And the novelty aspect of it, you mentioned this at the beginning, and I think it's a very astute observation that modern architects make buildings to win awards.
Yes.
They don't live in them. It's just this novelty idea that, you know, we make this building and then we win an award next year for the most creative building in our city or in our country or whatever. But then what about the suckers that have to live in the place for 30
exactly.
years? You know, that award does not go to make you have a nice
And that's the crazy part. You know, the only attribute that matters, you know, for modernists is when they build new today is that they're building is described as new thinking. You know, it doesn't matter. No one will care if it's good or any other qualities. It's just that it's new. It's described as new. It's groundbreaking. Is this groundbreaking good? Doesn't matter. They twisted the building in a certain way with a CAD program. So now it's new. No one has ever done it before. But was it necessary? Was it good? Doesn't matter. You win prizes by creating this crazy new, because then that's the highest, you know, attribute. That's the greatest thing you can have with a building in their sense of view.
Yeah, and it's remarkable why that would be something that you would want in your house. I mean, I get you'd want something fancy and new in a gadget that you get, like in your smartphone, maybe even in your car. Yeah, you get a special car, particularly for a second car. Let's say, you know, you have a family car, but you also get like a sports car. And yeah, it's innovative. It's groundbreaking. It has an engine that does things that are different. It can accelerate. And yeah, there's value, I guess, in mechanical and in electronic devices for novelty and for fashion items. But a home is a lot more functional. You want something that works. You want something that allows you to have a good life. There are many aspects of this. And I think one great way for me to understand why the classical tradition is important is that it's like with conservatives' ideas in general, it's not that they're good just because they're old, because everything old is better than everything that's new. It's good because it's old and it has survived. Yep. The fact that it has survived for very long suggests that there's something there. The fact that it survived centuries and millennia, in fact, of people building, you know, the column style. There's a reason why that's so popular. So many places all over the world, yeah, people build with it. And it's because it's functional. It's not just beautiful. It's beautiful to look at, but it's beautiful because it is functional. And I think
the function aspect we haven't touched, but it's good that you mentioned, yes, because now we build a lot of buildings in wet areas like Sweden with flat roofs. And it's like why would you do that? That's so stupid. That's inviting, you know, leakage. So, I shouldn't say this, but you know, the company I work for, we built a new storage facility and they made a flat roof. And what happened? We have lots of snow and rain. So there's leakage because, you know, usually in traditional in Sweden, you build, you know, slope roof so the water, you know, can run down. I was told, you know, because I saw an interview with a architect that I know, a classical architect. He made an interview about, you know, Norwegian vernacular in Bergen. It's a city in Norway where it rains a lot. So all the traditional houses, they are a bit sloped. Their facades are a bit sloped inwards so that, you know, that when the water rains, it will only damage the lower part of the building and not the upper part of the building. So you only need to, you know, when you do renovations, it's mostly focused on the bottom floor. Now with, you know, modernist buildings, they have no slopes. The facade is straight. So you get damage on the entire facade. So functionality-wise, it also, you know, all these traditions, all these how buildings look, of course there is a beauty aspect, but there is also a time-tested functional aspect. And if you throw that out, you get problems that shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't exist. Another, you know, very, very good example is when it comes to the Middle East, it's hot in the summer. So what they did, you know, if you have a city like Tel Aviv, that's a popular tourist destination now, what the British did is that they made the boulevards end up in the sea and they had clear way to the sea so that the ocean breeze should, you know, flow through into the city and cool it down. That was, you know, natural cooling in a very, very hot place. What did the modernists do in the 60s? They blocked all these, you know, all these boulevards with hotel buildings. So the city got a lot hotter. And you can see this probably in a million places in the Middle East and everywhere in the world.
It's exactly the same in downtown Beirut. If you walk in downtown Beirut is really beautiful. It got destroyed in the war, but it was rebuilt in, it wasn't so much rebuilt, it was renovated. The buildings were still standing mostly. There was some, but like a lot of the buildings survived. There was bullet holes rather than, you know, destructive air shelling that destroyed it. And so you walk around in downtown Beirut and yeah, you don't feel very hot. The buildings are 2-3 stories high and the way that the streets are shaped next to the sea brings in the breeze, so you don't feel very hot. You go to the parts of the town that were built modern, you know, you have all these fancy, long, big buildings, and then everything is a lot hotter there. You don't get the breeze, and within the buildings, of course, you need air conditioning. And so that just becomes enormously more expensive because, in fact, you could actually live for a very long time in Beirut, and it was manageable during the summer, even during the heat, because the architecture was made in such a way that was there.
You use, you know, the natural elements. You use the ocean breeze for cooling. This is, you know, if we go back to what we spoke about, you know, environment and ecology, air conditioning is consuming a lot of electricity and contributing to climate change. So why not use these traditional techniques of you know, city planning to lower the need? You will not eliminate the need for air conditioning, but you can definitely lower it by using all these traditional techniques. In Iran, they have a very interesting technique. They probably have it in the Gulf as well, with using, with these wind towers, where they don't have a sea breeze. They build wind towers that, you know, collect, you know, the wind and flows it down naturally in the building, thus cooling it down. So there are so many, you know, old techniques that we can use to lower, you know, our energy consumption. And we should understand that we can learn from people that lived in the past. They have wisdom and knowledge, and we should even admire them, because they built all these magical places that we still can't, you know, replicate today, despite being more technologically advanced.
Yeah, I think a great quote here from an author named Donald Kingsbury. I'm not familiar with the author, but I've heard the quote and it stuck with me. It says, "Tradition is a set of solutions for which we have forgotten the problems." Mm. Throw away the solution and you get the problem back.
Yes.
Sometimes the problem has mutated or disappeared, but often it is still there as strong as it ever was. I think that's a very, very powerful argument. And I think it's true in architecture. It's true in all kinds of different things. So you look at an old classical building and you think, wow, look at all that space that's wasted on those columns. Who needs those columns? You'd rather use that for bigger bedrooms. You'd rather use that for more apartments. And then you do that and you realize, you're thinking here, you know, the thinking of the modernist is, look, we're coming up with the more efficient way to do it. Let's put more apartments in. It'll make each apartment cheaper. It'll make the house more affordable. But as we said, you know, the problems that tradition was there to solve aren't going to go away. And I think that's extremely, extremely true. And it's sad how much of those traditions are being forgotten.
Yes.
So in many of those places, people are just... Yeah, it's sad. You look at the cities of the world, you look at the modern buildings, you can't tell where a building is. You look at a building, it could be Dubai, it could be in Stockholm, it could be in Rio de Janeiro, it could be
anywhere. Architecture without identity, just reducing every person on the planet to a global consumer. You know, everything that what it means to be human is reduced to, you know, exchangeable consumer.
Yeah, and like, even if you were for that kind of hyper-consumerism, on a purely economic level, say you were happy to be eating McDonald's and everybody else in the world eats McDonald's, but everybody can eat McDonald's because we all have the same biology, but we don't have the same geography. And so our buildings can't all be McDonald's, because it's different. The people in Stockholm need a different building from the people in Dubai. And
yes,
you can make them similar if you put a lot of money on heating and cooling, but you can also design them in a traditional way that would probably suit the needs of the people in those places a lot more.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm reminded of the work of Jane Jacobs. Are you familiar with her? I'm sure you must be, right?
Yes. She's very much worshipped in the urbanist circles, I know. So.
Yeah. She's done pretty work that would many people would call Hayekian. I don't think she references Hayek and speaks of Austrian economists, but her work is very much in that tradition, in that, you know, she looked at New York City and Robert Moses, I think his name was, the architect who was...
Yeah, the urban planner of the 60s that just cut through all the old fabric and built motorways.
Exactly. And that was the idea, you know, we're just going to do this modern city, and it ended up destroying all these amazing neighborhoods where people had lived for decades. And I think, you know, the fascinating thing to go to talk about the unintended problems that emerge from this is, well, when you've done the more efficient thing of, let's take all these 100 little houses and put them into one big building, and then we'll have everything more efficient. Well, now you've got all these high rises and all these affordable housing buildings, and you've lost the community. You've lost what she calls the eyes on the street. Yes. The fact that you had a community, you had all these people living together, everybody knew everybody, multi-generational friendships and families and relationships, and people were intermarried. And so everybody had an incentive to behave well because eyes were around you all the time and people don't forget. So, you know, you do something stupid, they're not going to let you marry their daughter. The neighbors know that you're the guy who does the stupid things. We're not going to let you marry our daughter. And so people had an incentive to behave. Now you take all of that, everybody's in their matchbox apartment.
They're alienated from everyone else and anonymous also.
Yeah, so. And then when you go into the field in the area outside the park, there's nobody because there's nothing to do. So very few people know who you are, and you can get away with a lot more. And that's a big factor in the crime increase that you see with modernization, yes, of cities.
And that's what we see. You know, I mentioned China earlier, you know, and their problems, you know, with the high rises, because as you mentioned, you know, in the Hutong environment in China, in the traditional Chinese cities, people knew their neighbors, you know, there were both social control, but there were also, you know, if an old person was alone, people helped that person, you know, with food. If you needed, you know, daycare for your children, you just ask the neighbor. Now people are, you know, have been pushed in 40 stories high rises. No one knows anyone. Everything is alienated. You have no connections, and people can die alone. So,
yeah.
What progress? You know, we were promised progress, but instead we got problems that we didn't have before.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very sad how people have internalized the idea that these problems are just the price that we have to pay for progress. That, you know, a lot of people just think it's a normal part of living in a city that, you know, your car is going to get carjacked and you might get killed and there's be violence, you might get mugged. But hey, you're living in a city. That's the price you have to pay for having a variety of cuisines in your city. And that's the price you have to pay for being in a vibrant labor market. But that's not the case. In fact, it's the exact opposite. The whole point of cities was that it allows us to be civilized and we can live next to each other. And the more urbanized humans became, the less crime and the less violence generally existed.
Yes.
Until recently.
It can be, you mentioned New York, and it's easy to compare it. You know, there was a mayor blackout in New York in the early 60s, and then there was one in the middle of the 70s. These were just like 15 years apart, but what a difference. You know, the blackout in New York in the early 60s, it was a calm affair. It was before, you know, the highways and everything. So there were communities. There were no rioting. There were no looting. People were calm and just walked around and, you know, and almost enjoyed themselves, you know, the spectacular view that all the city was dark. Then 15 years later, in the 70s, where everything had fallen apart, there were motorways, there were no flight from the cities, there was looting, there were burning buildings, there were skyrocketing crimes, there were burglars, there were rapes, everything, you know. So what a difference, you know, this can mean, you know, when you have a community and when you have atomized the city. And it was such a short time. I think this documentary, you know, that where they compare the blackouts, I think this is on YouTube. I think I saw it on YouTube. But I should find a link and really send you, you know, so you can, you know, because it's so striking, you know, what difference a community makes and the urban form.
Absolutely. All right. Dimitri, who's joining us today, is an architect, and I follow him on Twitter, and he posts interesting things, and I've got plenty of ideas from him. He's also a Bitcoiner, and he's got a question for you. How do we get, Dimitri, you want to go ahead and ask it?
Hey there. Hey, guys. Technically.
Hello.
Hey, technically, can't call myself an architect, but I can call myself a designer. So
okay.
Just to get that out of the way. yes. So I've been, you know, following Bitcoin architecture for a while, kind of trying to see how those two are connected. And there's many ways, you know, to do that. And I've been seeing Bukele, president of El Salvador, you know, get on the Bitcoin train. And my question is, you know, there's a lot of relationship between Bitcoin architecture, all these things that you guys are talking about. You know, I think the connection is that these things are based on truth and facts rather than people's opinions, right? Bitcoin's based on math, on these basic truths that exist in the world. And so is architecture, traditional classical architecture. And, you know, as you see a country jump on the Bitcoin wagon, it would be such a great way for them to use these truths in other aspects of their, you know, of the country. For example, they're planning to build a city, I think. I don't know. I think it's mostly just, I don't know how close they are to actually, you know, breaking ground or starting construction. But is there a way to help these people, these countries understand that, you know, they're accepting the truth about Bitcoin? They should also look into the truth about architecture and urban design. How do we encourage people like that, countries like that, organizations like that to, you know, to consider traditional classical architecture? So that's kind of my question.
Yeah. First, very nice to see you live. I follow you on Twitter.
Yes, I follow you too. So it's nice. Yeah, good to meet you.
See you in person.
Good to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Actually quite easy in these countries, and you have projects now. You have classical architecture now in Mexico, in Guatemala. You have a whole new neighborhood, Ciudad Cayala, mm-hmm. that they're building in central Guatemala. They are building this in El Salvador. I think the thing is with the Spanish speaking world, the Latin American world, they have not become woke yet. So they have not learned that if you like classical architecture, you are a Nazi. So there's no social negativity to like beauty and classical architecture. This makes it much easier sell. And so in that sense, I don't think there is a problem. The only problem is, of course, the supply of classical architects. So what you do is that these architects are almost always trained in Notre Dame University in the US. So you need simply invite more students, make more commercial to these students. Then they'll come back to their home countries and then they will build. You have classical architects now in Ecuador, Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, to mention a few, and there are some in Brazil. In Brazil, there are also. It's a big country, and you have at least one North American firm, classical firm, Ramza Robert Stern. He has built projects now in Lima, so it's gradually coming to Latin America, and because they don't speak so good English yet, they haven't learned that they should not like this, that they are not allowed to like this, because that they are white supremacists or something if they like classical architecture.
Yeah.
Yet. I say this yet, but so unfortunately, you know, the US is in a way the new Soviet Union as an exporter of bad ideas. So yeah. Good ideas also, I would say. You know, I'm very pro-American, but this ideology can, of course, spread to Latin America, and then they will learn that this is white European, blah blah blah, and you shouldn't do this. You should build modernism because it's, not Nazi, mm-hmm. as the argumentation in the US and then even still parts of Europe. So I hope it was a little bit wide answer, but I hope understood that there is things happening on the ground in these countries. And they are successful. They build not only private villas, but they build entire neighborhoods. And especially this project, you know, Ciudad Cayala in Guatemala City, because it's a country and a city that's very plagued by violence. Here you have like an urban oasis where regular Guatemalans, not expensive ones, it's not a gated community, mm-hmm. can just stroll around, enjoy themselves in a beautiful setting. Mm-hmm. And they love it. And they're expanding this community.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. Do you think we're headed toward a revival of those things? Like, I know you're part of this. You've named a lot of projects all over the world that are very exciting. But do you think, which way is the wind blowing? Are we going to get more good architecture, or is it going to be more modernist architecture? Because yes, there is a growth in classical architecture, but probably there's even more growth in the modernist architecture, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, classical architecture is still a niche. It's like 1% of everything, no, probably less than 1% of everything built. But the good thing is that at least, you know, because of the scale of the world and everything that is built, it's enough to support a growing number of classical architects. And as long as we keep the flame alive, Then, you know, the second thing important, that's what I work with because I'm not an architect, is, you know, the public debate. And as I mentioned here in Scandinavia, especially in Norway and Sweden, it has gone very far. We have really changed, you know, the public discourse. You know, politicians listen to us now. Politicians override their municipal experts that want to build modernist and build classical. But it's a super tanker because there are so many instances, so many institutions and people that need to be, you know, educated in classical tradition, and even, you know, all the bureaucrats need to be changed. But things are happening and it can happen. So you have a successful, you know, change of the debate in Norway. You have one in Sweden. You have similar organizations now in Finland, in Estonia. In Germany, they are working very hard to create one. You have one in the UK. You even have one in Croatia, you have one in the Netherlands, and recently one was started in Israel. And I hope there will be one in Lebanon and all of the Middle Eastern countries. So there is a growing global boom movement. Thanks to the internet, everyone is connecting to each other and sharing, you know, experience. And always, you can always use a tactic that we use to, you know, to stress, to make this discussion, you know, advance further. Is, you know, competition. You know, every country has one country that they admire. So if this country does classical, then we must do it as well. This worked very well. You know, in the example of Sweden, everything that happens in Berlin and New York, we must do the same. So when I published, you know, when I began, you know, advocating in Sweden, I published almost exclusively project from Berlin and New York to show that these, you know, very advanced places do it. Then we must do it. That, you know, advanced the discussion with 10 years because you don't have to talk about things being backward because no one will claim that Berlin or New York are backward places. So you share strategies and you can do it in many different countries. So what countries does Belgium look up to? What countries does the UK look up to? What countries do you Lebanon look up to? And show examples from these places. We share experience how you do it. And then you advance public discussion and you advance, you know, public imagination that we can build this, because it's very important to not only show renders and say we should, to show actual built projects. Because if you only show something that has been built, then you cannot deny that it was possible. It was possible in a cost, you know, cost, all these factors was solved. So things are changing. Things are changing for the better. It doesn't go as fast as we want them to. But there is an embryo now, especially when I compare it to when I began all this, you know, in 2013, there has been a real explosion, both in terms of quality, in terms of quantity, and the amount of young people that want, that know now that you can become a classical architect and want to study to become a classical architect. So yeah, it's an oil tanker, but classical architecture will not die. It will only grow stronger, you know, for every year. And then hopefully we can advance it even more. The biggest problem now is institutional learning. I told you there is only one university in the entire world, Notre Dame in the US. We have summer courses in Europe, but you need, you know, university programs. When we got that, you know, proper faculties and everything, then we have won. Because then you will get, you know, a steady flow of new educated classical architects. And if you educate classical architects, they will build classical architecture.
Yeah, and I think another positive point here to keep in mind is that, well, classical architecture lasts, whereas modernist architecture is faster, decays very quickly. So basically, you could say one classical building is like three modernist buildings, because you need to build three modernist buildings to survive as long as the classical one, if not more. So, you know, at least the ones that you built last longer. So eventually you win.
Yeah. In the long term, you know, modernists will just be a blip, you know, in human architectural history. Unfortunately, we live in that blip now. But in the long run, you know, in 100 years or 200 years, everywhere we will return to classical tradition then. It will not be that we build, you know, the same styles as before, but we will return to the framework and thinking how to design a building, and we will create new beautiful styles. And there will be new beautiful art as well. There will be no bananas, you know, with plaster on a wall. There will be artists that make figurative, beautiful figurative paintings and motifs.
Absolutely. I hope so. On that positive note, I want to thank you so much, Michael, for your time, for joining us, for all of your expertise and for everything that you do. It's an inspiration to see somebody work so hard on something that is beautiful and really good for people. So best of luck to you. And next time we have you over, you better have gotten into Bitcoin.
Thank you very much for having me and having this discussion, you know, for your viewers. I really appreciate it. And thank you also for what you are doing. It seems like a noble cause. Even if you want monarchies, you know, removing power from government is always a good thing. And I applaud that, you know. I'm so sick of concentration of power, I tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not the only one. The whole world is getting sick of it. I think that's a positive thing, at least. People are waking up to it a lot.
Okay. Thank you very much for having
me. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. Cheers.